listening to Out of the Box Podcast with Rosie Tran. Guys, don't forget to go on iTunes and leave a positive review. Positive reviews are the number one way that people find out about us, because iTunes then puts a little thumbs up and pushes us higher, and more people can find us. Also sharing the podcast with friends and family. And as always, we're on SoundCloud and Stitcher. I am so excited today. I have a very special guest, Dr. Rachel Parziali. She's a clinical psychologist. Rachel, how are you?
Good, good. Thank you so much for having me on today, Rosie.
Good. I'm so excited to have you. I've had, as you guys, listeners know, a number of psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, and I'm very pro mental health. But really what I want to delve into with you today is something that I haven't talked about that much on the podcast. I've had different mental health professionals talking about different aspects of mental health, but I'm really an advocate for every single person learning healthy communication, healthy emotional intelligence, working on themselves, because I really truly believe that the majority of the problems created in this world are from people who don't know themselves that well and have problems that they're putting out there into the world. And it seems like there's still in the 2000s, which is ridiculous, a huge stigma about getting mental health and healthy.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think, you know, to destigmatize mental health, we need to talk about it. And that's why I'm glad to be here today and to really delve into some of these issues.
I think it's really, really big, especially for me, being a minority. You know, I was talking to a girlfriend who's Hispanic American, and she is always telling me about all her problems. And she's like, well, I probably should go to a therapist, but Latinas, we don't go to therapy. And I hear that a lot. You know, in my culture, I'm Vietnamese. I always hear my parents saying, well, therapy, that's something for white people, or that's something if you're crazy. And I noticed that that's something you're Persian American. Have you experienced this type of stigma in the Persian American community?
Oh, absolutely. I think in the Persian community, there's this belief that mental health is reserved for people who are crazy. And if you go into therapy, then there, you know, must be something wrong with you. Even if people don't really express this idea externally, they do hold on to these beliefs internally. And this idea that therapy is something that, you know, just as we go to the gym to
work out, strengthen
our body, we need to go to therapy to strengthen our psyche. So that's becoming a little bit more widespread, but still there is a lot of stigma there.
There is. And full disclosure to all the listeners, I have been to therapy. I loved it, and it was so helpful. I've also been to couples counseling with my hubby, and it was totally awesome. Speaking of counseling, I really want to also dispel the myth. So many people that I talk to about going to see a therapist, psychologist, psychiatrist, they say things like, you know, well, what am I going to do? Just sit there and talk to the person. And they don't understand that there's this whole realm of communication, our upbringing, our beliefs, all these negative family dramas. I mean, we're human. There's like, everyone has issues. It's like totally normal. And everyone knows that everyone has issues. Yet there's this idea of you're sitting or laying on a couch and, you know, the judgmental psychologists with their little notebook just judging and taking notes. And I don't know where this comes from. I don't know if it's from the media or what has your experience been?
Yeah, I do think that some people have that image in mind. But, you know, it's interesting that once people come to therapy and they have the courage to come to therapy, and after they experience some of that discomfort and that dissipates, they realize that it's not such a bad process. It's actually a collaborative process. It's not someone sitting on the other side and judging you and trying to dissect you, but it's about someone who's trying to develop a sense of rapport and connection with you and help you connect and develop a sense of rapport to yourself, to the parts of yourself that need to be expressed. So therapy can provide a space for that.
I love that you said the word collaborative, because every single stereotype I've seen of therapy in the media is someone laying on a couch just talking and talking. And my experience in therapy was very collaborative. I felt like my therapist was a partner with me with figuring out solutions to my problems. And who doesn't have problems? I mean, come on, it's like therapy should be mandatory.
That would be great if it was.
But some people may think they don't have any issues at all. And you are an expert, or you've talked about something that is so mind-blowing. It's intergenerational trauma. Yes. And that's something that I really want to discuss, because a lot of people say, well, I don't have any problems, or I don't have any issues. And you might even have problems or issues that you're not even aware of.
Right. You know, usually when people come to therapy, they come in for one concern. And then as therapy progresses, they realize that what's being uncovered isn't even what they came in to begin with. And
there's something underneath.
Something underneath. And you brought up intergenerational transmission of trauma. And that's something I want to get into today as I talk about.
What is that? For the listeners who are like, what is this she's talking about?
So intergenerational transmission of trauma is trauma that gets passed on from generation to generation. So when we talk about trauma, first I want to give a little definition of what it is. So trauma is an experience that we endure either directly or indirectly, in which we experience a sense of a threat to our psyche, a threat to our physical well-being, a threat of violence or death. And this experience overwhelms our normal capacity to function. So the actual event is not what's traumatic. It's our experience of that event. So when we experience something that overwhelms our psyche, we experience an array of emotions, mm-hmm. from terror to fear to being out of control to rage, and these emotions aren't able to be expressed. So what ends up happening is that they stay frozen in us. They quite literally stay frozen in our bodies, and that's what becomes traumatic. And intergenerational transmission of trauma is that these traumatic experiences that become frozen in us get passed on from one generation to another, until they're recognized, they're acknowledged, and they're healed.
So let me process this in layman's terms for some of the listeners. Are you talking about maybe someone being in an abusive marriage, for example, and then their son or daughter grows up with that type of trauma and then attracts, again, another abusive spouse or lover, and then they do not heal that expression of pain, so then they give birth to another son or daughter who then keeps repeating this cycle. We hear a lot about cycles in psychology.
Exactly.
Okay, got it.
So it could be something as extreme as domestic violence getting passed on, or Holocaust survivors, the trauma getting passed on to their children and their grandchildren. Or trauma can also be something not as drastic and extreme. You know, I want to expand the definition of trauma that we have. Usually when we think of trauma, we think of things...
Something
really bad, like sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. But trauma, especially in early development, can also be the things that were supposed to happen that didn't happen.
Give me some examples.
So for example, for normal development to occur, a child, an infant, needs a parent who's attuned to her needs. What I mean by that is a parent who's aware of her needs, aware not just of her bodily physical needs, but
emotional, mental, yes, developmental.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if there's a child whose parents are preoccupied, let's say they're going through financial distress, so they're focused on basic survival needs. They're not going to be able to have as much emotional capacity to sit and process, you know, their child's hurt feelings, for example. So that experience in itself can be traumatic. Maybe I could give an example of my own history of intergenerational trauma and how that's come about. So my grandmother, a lovely woman, very sensitive, very kind woman. So she and my grandfather get married, and they're in love. And once they get married, my grandmother's in-laws and her, extended family just become very mean to her. They're very...
Do you know what this was related to, or just random?
I really don't know how it came about. My grandfather was the firstborn, and I imagine there was some traumatic experience between him and his family. So just this act of him distancing or separating from his own family and getting married, caused this, traumatic experience that happened for my grandmother. So my grandmother is under stress, and she's trying to cope with it the best way she can. Then my mother is born, who is the first, my grandmother's first child. And my grandmother, in an effort to try to heal herself, to try to make sense of what's going on with her, over discloses a lot of her emotional pain to my mother. So she, kind of uses my mom as a confidant.
I know, using her as a therapist.
Right. Which, at that time, if there was therapy, I'm sure my grandmother may have taken, gone to that, but that wasn't available. So then that's passed on to my mom. And my mom, as a young kid, who's obviously very loyal to her own mother, as every child is, and my mom, a very sensitive person, takes in that pain. So experiences secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, just from hearing all these accounts of my grandmother being distressed. So my mom then in turn really takes that in. And again, you know, during the time that she was being raised, therapy is not an option. It's not something at all even known. So she doesn't have a place to really process that, to digest that. But somewhere in her psyche, she makes this silent promise to herself that once she becomes a mother, she's going to protect her kid. And she's going to do that by not over-disclosing her emotional state.
It's a reaction. Yes. Instead of a healing and a holistic, it's kind of a reaction.
Exactly. So it's going to the opposite extreme. Instead of being so overly disclosing as my grandmother was to her, she was going to be more contained. But so then I'm born.
You're born.
First.
Yay.
Yay. So first born. And my mom, in an effort, again, coming from a very loving place, in an effort to protect me, she doesn't disclose what's going on with her. And she takes it a step further and becomes kind of emotionally unable to really express her emotions in general.
Shut down.
To me. Yeah. A little bit emotionally shut down. And what that causes is a rupture in our ability to form a close relationship. So you see two generations here. My mom having a rupture in her relationship with her mother because my grandmother was over disclosing, and then me having a rupture in my dynamic with my mom early on because of you know, the difficulty in relating. So then what happens to me? I become a psychologist.
A recipe for psychologists.
So I'm the generation that, you know, luckily I have the resources, the capacity to deal with this trauma. I have the resources that are available to me that weren't available to my mom and my grandmother. And I'm able to really look at this maternal rupture, this rupture in attachment, and to really digest what that means, to really feel the pain of what that means, to experience it in therapy, to grapple with it. And I'm able to transform that in a way of going back and creating a healthy relationship with my mom.
Or going forward with your future children.
Exactly. Going forward with my future children and going forward with all the patients I treat. It's become something that I can, because I've integrated that and continuously integrated. It's a lifelong process, but integrating that experience of that attachment rupture, that's something that I can give to my patients, a knowledge that I can, you know, help them with.
This is very interesting. Now, a lot of my listeners are huge nerds, so they're probably all wondering, okay, Rachel, is there scientific evidence to support these things that you're talking about?
Definitely. I mean, if you know, you look up
or is this pseudoscience? I know a lot of people use that term. It's pseudoscience. How can you pass trauma from one person to the other if it's not happening to that physical third person?
Right. So there's different ways in which this can happen, and you know, you just go search on the internet. There's just so many studies on this. So one way in which trauma gets passed on, and this is a field that's becoming really popular, is epigenetics. So it's the study of how genes, the expression of genes, can be influenced by the environment. So they see that, for example, in children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors, it's not that their genes change from one generation to the next, but it's that the expression of those genes change because of the influence of the traumatic environment. Mm. You also see that in, for example, children with parents who've experienced some kind of trauma, there's dysregulated levels of cortisol. So cortisol is a stress hormone. So their levels of cortisol is different than the level of cortisol in someone who hasn't been in a traumatic environment or hasn't had parents who've had trauma. So genetics is definitely one way in which trauma could get passed on from one generation to the next. Another way is behavior. So we learn way of relating through our parents. They're our first attachments, our mother especially. She's our first attachment to the world.
And our brain is a big sponge when we're a little kid, yes. Right? So it's like just sucking everything.
Absolutely. Those first 5 years are so formative. So you're just taking it all in. And so much of it is nonverbal, you know? So you're taking in the way that an infant has to be really attuned to her mother, because her mother is her lifeline. The mother's well-being is really important to the infant. So the infant becomes very attuned to the mother. So in a normal situation where the mother is not traumatized, the mother can be available to the child. But in a situation where the mother has experienced her own trauma and hasn't healed her own trauma, this makes her unavailable to the infant and makes her not able to really be receptive to the infant's emotional needs. So the infant picks up experiences from that, picks up knowledge about the world, how the world works, who she is, from the way her mother relates to her. So if, for example, a mother is unavailable because of her own traumatic experience, has low tolerance for emotional distress, then the infant learns that, you know what, if I scream, if I express distress, my mom isn't gonna respond to me, so I'm just, you know, I'm gonna shut down. There's this, you know, unconscious, it obviously the infant doesn't have verbal language to express that at the time, but there's this unconscious thing that happens that the infant learns that if I cry, there isn't going to be anyone there. And so you've seen even studies where infants, for example, are left in the crib for some time.
Yeah, there's a crack baby study where they, yes, when infants are not given enough attention, then their brain actually develops less. It's all sorts of things.
Exactly.
And there's the same study with poverty, which is a very harrowing statistic, because the poverty in America and in developing nations is growing and high. And just that fight or flight mentality, you're trying to pay the bills. You're not going to care about what Junior, you know, they're, like you said, who cares about emotional needs and other things? I got to pay the electric bill. And so that can cause a lot of trauma. So, you know, a lot of, I preach hard financial intelligence and education on this podcast. And that's one of the reasons, because there is trauma that can be caused by lack or interpretation of lack.
Absolutely. I mean, hierarchy of needs, right? Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We first need to take care of our basic needs for survival, safety, food, shelter, before we can attend to higher needs of emotional care. So if a parent is in a survival mode and they need to take care of themselves, they need to take care of this infant's survival needs, the emotional needs are secondary. And you also see that a lot in, for example, people who acculturate to a new country, they immigrate. That's a stressful experience. And once they immigrate to the new culture, it's all about survival. It's about, okay, how do we get food? How do we, kind of get situated in this culture? And a lot of times those kids of immigrants also experience of trauma, acculturative trauma of their needs are put to the side. There is no room. When you're, you know, fleeing a country that's in war, the last thing you're thinking about is, let's talk about what you're feeling right now. There's really no space for that.
It's important that you said that. You said, let's talk about what you're feeling, because I find that there seems to be a very dismissiveness or demasculinization of feelings. And feelings are something that obviously every single human being, whether you're male or female, has. And it's starting to become a little bit more popular for men to express feelings. But there still seems to be this really strong cultural stigma around men expressing their feelings. And to me, that's such a huge thing, because men, that's 50% of our society.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like men are given the capacity to experience anger,
and
like,
that's about it,
that,
right?
Yeah, that's acceptable, you know. But if a man experiences sadness or vulnerability, it's a sign of weakness. And so, you know, I'm a big proponent of honoring our own femininity, you know, and femininity is something that we all have. We all have masculine attributes, characteristics, and feminine ones. And the feminine characteristics are the parts of us that are able to receive, able to be vulnerable, able to feel. And when we shut that aspect of ourselves out, it's we can't establish a coherent sense of self. We kind of become a shell of a person that just is about doing and attending to our masculine side, which is about doing, being assertive, getting things done. And then all these, you know, feminine attributes of us, the emotional side, the right brain side, gets put to the side. And then it's pretty much of an empty existence that, you know, that we experience as a result.
Now, why do you think so many people, I mean, I talk to people on a regular basis that, you know, maybe I'm being judgmental, but I think, oh gosh, this person really needs to go to a therapist. And it just seems like so many people just are, that's for crazy people. Is it because of the bad PR, the one flew over the cuckoo's nest in the 70s, you know, people don't want to get electric shocked, or do you think that it's just because it's a new field in the past 100, 200 years?
I definitely think that has a lot to do with it, that, you know, there's a lot of stigma out there around mental health and what it is and all of that. But I think there's something else underlying, which is it's extremely vulnerable and even terrifying to emotionally depend on another human being. So when we look at trauma and wounds, they happen within a context of a relationship. We experience trauma when we depend on someone emotionally and we're hurt as a result.
So that's very, very interesting that you say that. Okay.
So going to therapy, you're pretty much putting yourself in a situation where you're vulnerable, you're emotionally dependent on another human being, and you're giving space to all these emotions that you've warded off, you've disavowed.
Pushed down, shoved down, kick to the back, ignore.
Yeah, you're basically saying, I give you permission to come forth. And that's a really scary thing. So it takes tremendous courage to do that. And I think a lot of people rather not, or rather find an easy way out, or, you know, distractions are
drink or party, yeah, or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Distractions can offer a sense of immediate relief, but obviously they don't work in the long run. So I think the whole experience of going to therapy is just really vulnerable, and it's us facing ourselves. And that's not something we are taught to do. It's not something that's valued in our culture.
And not just that, but you say give the space, the room for these emotions to come forth. Some people don't even realize, like you said many times, some people go to therapy for one reason. Hey, I'm having issues with my husband. And then they find out, oh my God, I have issues with my mom from, you know, 1975 or something like that. This is not just, hey, I pushed, you know, emotions from last week down to the bottom of the belly. Some of this is stuff from 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, the things that, especially that happen in the formative years of our lives, the childhood years are the ones that really shape our outlook of life. And we'd like to believe that whatever traumatic experience happened, yeah, it's back then, it's not affecting us now. But I mean, this is science. Science shows that, you know, the early experiences do follow us, do shape the way we relate to ourselves, relate to the world. And we may be able to push them aside for some time. Our defenses may be intact and pushing them aside, but then some life happens, right? Someone dies, you give birth, you get married. So something will happen that will trigger you. So I work a lot with sexual abuse survivors, and a lot of times sexual abuse survivors will come to therapy when there's a traumatic event that happens that resurfaces their past trauma. And the traumatic event could be like, you know, the death of somebody, or it could be something even positive, like their child turns 5 years old and they were molested when they were five. So all of a sudden they're flooded.
All these feelings come back.
Yeah, they're flooded with all these feelings that they didn't even know existed. So yeah, it's, you know, your defenses will be intact to some extent, and defenses meaning ways in which your psyche keeps you away from re-experiencing the terror of those feelings that, you know, are inside of your body. But at some point, those defenses will just won't work anymore. And you may in the moment feel very scared by that. Like, I feel like I'm going crazy. I mean, I hear that a lot from people who've experienced trauma and they're starting to re-experience those feelings. It's like, I'm going crazy. I don't know what's going on with me. I feel out of control. Yes, you are, you know, you do feel out of control, but it's actually a very sobering experience. It's actually the opposite of being crazy. It's you're finally giving
dealing
way.
With it.
Yeah, you're giving way to, giving space to those feelings to come forth.
And I want to address something that you said earlier, because I started getting chills when you started talking about the example of the mother not being emotionally available and dealing with her own stuff and not being available for the kid. Because a lot of times, like you mentioned earlier in the podcast, a lot of people think trauma is, hey, you were raped, you came from a war zone, something crazy. And, you know, I grew up in what would be considered traditionally a very happy home. My parents were both married, unfortunately now divorced. And I had was provided for a very middle class background. And my mom was like spaced out to the wazoo. And so whatever trauma she experienced, whether it was the Vietnam War or some type of personal trauma, which she, similar to your mom, has not shared with me at all, it was affecting her and it affected me. Because although I wasn't beaten, abused, you know, hair ripped out, whatever that you would consider, quote unquote, abuse, quote unquote, trauma, it did affect me as far as, you know, I felt that there was something off growing up. And I think a lot of people are fearful of going to get help because they're like, well, I didn't have a bad childhood. You know, I grew up in a suburban what, or I had good parents. And so they don't really feel, I've heard that a lot from people that, well, I don't feel like I'm quote unquote messed up. But yet when they go deeper, it turns out that they do have trauma. Because as you said, trauma can be as simple as not feeling like your needs are met.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, I think you're alluding to the fact that emotional trauma doesn't leave the same scars as physical trauma, you know, and it's not as it's you can't see it in the same way that you can for like physical trauma or sexual trauma. So emotional trauma, it's hard to even say, oh, that actually did happen. And that did impact me. And a lot of times, you know, I hear this all the time where like a kid comes from a great family, parents love them, but there's just so many needs that weren't met. And when we start delving into the trauma, a lot of times the patient may feel like if I talk about what happened, then that means I'm saying that my parents didn't love me or they didn't.
That they were bad parents,
yeah, they're
or
bad
something.
Parents,
yeah.
Or they didn't do a good job. It's totally different. I mean, I can say from my own experience, my grandma loves and adores my mom. My mom loves and adores me. It has nothing to do with it. You can love your child and still pass trauma on to him or her, even without wanting to.
Mm. So what can parents do? What can a parent do to, because I, you know a slew of unconscious parents, and I think that, you know, conscious parenting would be great for society. You know, I unfortunately we turn on the news on a daily basis and there's another tragedy, so it seems like, you know, the earth needs a big group hug right now. And what can a parent or an anticipatory parent, someone who's thinking of having kids, do to help as much as possible? Obviously complete perfect childhood doesn't exist, to prevent or try to prevent some of this happening.
You know, we can't change what we're not aware of, right?
Mm.
We can't change what we don't label, when we don't identify. So I would say the first and foremost thing is create a connection with yourself. Like get to know yourself, get to know why you are the way you are, why you behave the way you do. If there is a way in which you are relating to people or to yourself that you feel like, well, you know, I don't know if that's the healthiest way, like be curious about it. I think holding a curious attitude is really important, because curiosity then allows the possibility of us exploring and understanding. So for a parent who is a parent or wants to become a parent, understanding their own history, what impacted them, feeling the pain of what they experienced will definitely help in their own parenting. And a lot of times we don't know, you know, what the things are that impacted us. But once we become parents and we're triggered by our kids, then those things come to rise. Like I said before, like that parent who's you know, daughter turns 5 and all of a sudden she realizes like she's flooded with all these feelings. So when these feelings come to you, give space to them. What we don't give space to, we act out, right? So if you don't give space to those feelings, if you don't allow yourself to acknowledge it, to feel it, to express it, to transform it, for example, through art, through expression of some sort, then you act it out.
So what does that mean, act out, for the listeners who are like, what is she talking about?
Okay, so for example, a parent who herself was sexually molested and never dealt with that most likely has a, you know, deep mistrust of people because she was violated by someone who she probably trusted at some point.
So maybe being overprotective of the kids. Exactly. To the point of, you know, fanaticism or something.
Yeah, so acting out would be like not allowing her daughter to go out anywhere, being extremely overprotective, being really angry and hostile with her daughter or her son or, you know, her child. So not having dealt with her own feelings, it comes out in more aggressive and angry ways rather than kind of
healthy. Yeah, instead of saying, hey, you can go out with your friends, but just be careful. It's like, oh, you don't know what's going to happen to you, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, it's as if like the parent isn't aware of what she's feeling and she's putting all of her feelings onto her kid. She's projecting it onto the kid.
All right, let's talk about bad therapists. Because I have had a bad therapist and fortunately switched. And I've heard several of my friends who have been in therapy say that they've had bad therapists. Are there bad therapists, or is it just you're not a good fit? I don't know. It's kind of like dating, right? You got to find the right fit.
Yeah, the right fit is important. I mean, I guess in every profession, there's not so great, you know, professionals who are practicing that profession. But the studies have shown that the thing that is most transformative in therapy is the rapport, the connection. So it's really important to find a therapist that you feel connected to.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing can happen in therapy without a sense of connection, safety, and trust. And especially for people who've had trauma. You know, what happens in trauma is that your sense of safety is shattered. So to be able to feel that in a therapeutic relationship, to feel a sense of safety and to develop that is extremely transformative and healing.
When you're in therapy, you're working on yourself. You're exploring yourself. You're exploring your emotions. But I personally would not recommend, you know, a lot of people would say, well, if I'm exploring myself, why do I need someone else? I would encourage a group, some type of group setting, or, you know, a support group or a therapist or a psychologist. But some people would ask, Rosie, why, if I'm exploring myself, why do I need these other people?
It's kind of like, you know, if you want to develop intimacy, you can read a lot about intimacy and you can, you know, maybe even read love stories and, I don't know, poems and Rumi quotes. But you really...
I love Rumi.
I do too. But you really learn intimacy when you're in a relationship. Or for example, even a simpler example of riding a bike. You can like read about it all you want, but you learn it through experience. And therapy is the same way. The things that we want to develop within ourselves, we can kind of, you know, think about it and read about it and intellectualize about it, but it really gets ingrained in us within a relationship. A relationship is what's healing, whether it's for trauma or any type of, you know, reason why you are going to therapy. It's that relationship with the therapist is really informative, because the way that you relate out in the world will come into the therapy room. If you have mistrust, for example, of people, or fear of intimacy, that will come into the therapy room with your therapist.
I want to point out something you said and elaborate on it. You mentioned intellectualizing. This is why I strongly and constantly urge everyone to go to, I honestly, I'm not just saying this, Rachel's not paying me, the psychological community has not paid me. I strongly believe every single person needs to at least go to therapy for a short period of time to discover themselves, because there is something to be said about very intelligent people, my podcast listeners, reading and listening and getting as much information as possible and intellectualizing. And unfortunately, that's not how we learn. We learn through intellectual and experiential learning.
Right.
In fact, experiential learning is the fastest way to learn. And so I am just advocating everyone out there to try it out, because that is so important. What you said about how we act out things, we're relational. That's why our primary relationship with our spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend is so important, because a lot of times there's can be great healing for childhood trauma in your primary relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, to the back to the intellectual thing, an intellectual understanding of anything is the first step. Like, you know, learning how to, you know, if you want to become a pilot, you need to study that, right?
Don't just go up there and wing it.
Right. But that's not what I meant. If you study how to fly a plane for like 1,000 hours and you never fly a plane, I don't know how trustworthy that pilot will be.
Perfect example, Rachel.
So, yeah, you need both. And a lot of times we, you know, a lot of people want to stay in the intellectual realm because it's safe.
It's very safe. You don't have to experience anything. You don't have to feel anything. It's like, let's just think about this.
Yeah, you don't have to feel uncomfortable emotions. I mean, why do we push emotions aside? We don't push emotions aside because they're comfortable and they're great. We push them aside because a lot of times those emotions are, they cause us discomfort. They make us feel afraid.
Let me clarify something that you said, because a lot of people don't understand the difference between intellectualizing and experiencing. So to clarify on the example that Rachel gave, it's like someone who is like, well, I have issues with intimacy because I was raped when I was little. I don't need to go to a therapist because I know that I was raped when I was little and I know that I have intimacy issues, and they've never physically experienced the pain of that trauma, but they quote unquote know, well, I know I have issues. I hear that a lot from people. I don't need to go to therapy because I already know what my issues are. I hear that all the time from people.
Yeah. And I always say, like, that's great that you've developed that ability to intellectually understand what's going on for you. But let's deal with some of those feelings that are connected to this knowing you have. So, you know, a lot of times what I do in therapy, especially for people who've experienced any kind of trauma, is as they're talking about their experience, I help them connect to their body. Because we can talk about an experience all we want in a very disconnected way, which is intellectualizing, and that's not really going to be healing. What's healing in therapy is to be able to talk about the experience in an emotionally connected way, in a safe environment, with a person that you're relating to. So to not just talk about it, but to feel what's going on, what are the sensations coming up. Let me, you know, maybe say a little bit about how regular memories and traumatic memories are stored. I think that will help a little bit. So when we have a positive experience or a neutral experience, it gets stored in us emotional upheaval around this event. It's kind of like you experience the event in your mind when you want to, you think about it, it produces pleasant or neutral feelings, and you put it aside, and you're able to have a narrative around this event. So you're able to talk about it to someone. So for example, I could say, like, 5 years ago, I went on a trip with my friends. It was great. I could describe the trip. I could give like coherent, linear, examples.
You're
of,
not
like,
cringing,
what happened.
Shaking in the corner. You're exactly. Just like telling about the trip. Okay.
Exactly. So I could talk about it in just a coherent way. But traumatic memories, like I said earlier, they're frozen in us, right? So there's not always words to describe them. They get frozen in a sense of that we experience them as sensations, bodily sensations and images. So what therapy does with time is that it helps you create a narrative, a story to the traumatic experience. So it takes it out of a traumatic event, which is like a frozen event that doesn't have words to express for you to express it, and it takes it into the realm of a more normal event, which is something that you can talk in to use words to describe
without getting
it.
Angry, without getting flustered, without getting
overwhelmed.
Charged.
Sure.
Why are emotions so important? I mean, emotions, it seems like our brain, right, psychology and mental health, it seems like it's associated with the brain. Yet there's this mind-body connection where it seems like almost your brain and your body just separate in a way with trauma. Because I know a lot of people that have had trauma and they're so smart and they're so intellectualized about it. And these are people, obviously, that haven't gone to therapy. And there seems to be a split. Do you,
That's absolutely true. It's, you know, a lot of times people who have been traumatized, it's like they live neck up and everything neck down is disconnected, dissociated. And the reason is because the traumatic, you know, the trauma, the traumatic experience overwhelmed their psyche, and it overwhelmed their psyche because there was all these feelings that happened that they weren't able to express. They weren't
to process.
Right. So those feelings get frozen inside their bodies. We don't want to feel those feelings. So we just disconnect it. It's kind of like a child who is tantruming and you don't want to hear it. So you just put it in the room and you lock it up. You know, that's pretty much what we do to ourselves. And, you know, to process, to heal from trauma, we have to integrate our mind and our body. So you have to really connect to your body. What's going on in my body? How am I feeling? What are these overwhelming sensations that are terrorizing me? Let me experience them. I'm too afraid to experience them alone. So that's where therapy comes in. You get to experience it in the presence of someone else, you know, with the help of a professional. It becomes less overwhelming. And with time, you start slowly, reconnecting more and more to yourself. Another thing that I think is really helpful in connecting to your body, especially for trauma survivors, is incorporating movement, body movement. So yoga is a great practice to...
Yoga is a wonderful mind-body practice.
Absolutely. Creating awareness of your body. Dance is a way of giving expression to your... giving a way to express the emotions that you're feeling in your body through movement.
Expressive fun dance.
Yeah. Dance without an agenda, you know, like just movement. Our bodies need movement. I'm also a big advocate for artistic expression. I mean, I'm an artist myself, and I incorporate that in my work, just as a person, as a psychologist. And so giving a way to express some of those feelings without words, right? Art can be a way to express that, those traumatic experiences, in a way that we don't necessarily have the words, or it's even greater than any words can describe.
It is, and it's really about finding the healthy way to process things. Like you said, it's just like going to the gym, but for your brain and your body, in a way. Now, I know that there's a big fear. I actually read an article online the other day that said one of the biggest fears and barriers for people going to therapy is this fear that, you know I have issues, right? Done, right? I know I need to work on them, done. But if I go to therapy, I'm going to be in therapy for like 20 years because I'm so crazy, blah, 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 blah. And I hear this, I've heard this personally from people, oh, well, they just want your money, or they're going to exploit me for all of my issues and all this other stuff. And I want to tell you, listeners, it does end. It ends. I'm done with both of my couples counselor and my one-on-one, and they were both beautiful, helpful women who helped me discover more about myself and on to the next adventure. But it's not, I don't know, have you heard of this fear?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the underlying fear that you're talking about is that if I open up Pandora's box,
I've been stuffing emotions for 60 years, Rosie. I'm not going to start letting them out now.
Yeah. And if I look at my pain, I'm going to drown in this like endless abyss of darkness, that this pain will never end. But grief has a beginning, has a middle, and has an end. You know, maybe I could talk a little bit about the recovery process and what that looks like. I would say, you know, obviously this is a generalization, but I would break it down into three stages or three levels, and it's not linear. I mean, it's not like one stage has to happen for the next one to start. But so in the beginning stages of working through trauma, it's about developing safety, developing trust. So that's, you know, with the therapist can help you develop a sense of safety in the relationship, with the therapeutic relationship, developing a sense of safety of being in your own body. Like you had just mentioned a couple of minutes ago, you disconnect from your body, you dissociate. So coming back to your body, regulating some of the bodily patterns like sleep, eating. Oftentimes, you know, people who are traumatized, they can't sleep. Their sleep is disturbed.
Listeners, I know some listeners that are not sleeping. Run to Rachel.
So developing a sense of safety. Then the next stage is you know, putting words to the traumatic experience, remembering the trauma, being able to talk about it in a narrative coherent way, and mourning. Oh, that is so incredibly important. A lot of people may feel like if I mourn what happened to me, it's kind of like I'm giving power to the perpetrator. I'm saying that they won, you know, like their impact, they were more powerful than me.
What about people who take the trauma as part of their identity? I mean, I meet people all the time that are like holding for dear life onto their victimness, right? Maybe something happened to them when they're little and they just love that negative storyline. Oh, well, I, you know, was a war survivor and you don't know what it was like out there and you don't know how horrible it was. And I mean, what's that all about?
It sounds like maybe they're experiencing some kind of secondary gain from that, from you know, maybe maintaining that victim role. They're creating a sense of specialness, or that's the way that they've been valued in their family. Like they're the sick one, you know, and that's how they receive love. That's how they receive care.
Because I've seen that, you know, oh, you don't know what it was like to be XYZ, or I grew up black, and so that's why I have to have suffered so much, or I've grown up as a woman in a blah, 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 blah. And that's what, and it's like they're clinging to it for dear life. And it's, I've seen that a lot recently.
Maybe they're clinging to it, but not really allowing themselves to experience the pain associated to it. Because all the things that you said, it sounds like maybe the person could have experienced trauma as a result of that, but they're not allowing themselves to fully go delve into those feelings and process them.
But I think you're right. There's also a sense of specialness. Uh-huh. Like, oh, I'm a war victim, or oh, I'm a, you know, XYZ.
Yeah, kind of specialness and a kind of way that you may get love, you know, from the people around you.
That's interesting, because I think a lot of people wouldn't think that, hey, I would get love from being a victim. But there's sympathy to be gotten and other
absolutely
things.
Sympathy, attention. A lot of times when especially I see teenagers quite a bit in my practice, and the teenager will come with bunch of symptoms, like a list of symptoms. And I see that, you know, the symptoms are a symptom of what's going on in the family, but it's this adolescent who is like, she's the identified patient is what we call them, like the person who is bearing all the family trauma, the family dysfunction.
Oh, that's so sad.
So usually there's, you know, in that adolescent maybe getting some kind of special attention for being the sick one in the family, or getting some kind of recognition for that. So to be able to create a new sense of identity is also part of the therapy of processing the trauma. So as you're creating a narrative, you're mourning the loss of what happened to you, mourning the loss of what was taken away from you, such as, for example, like your innocence or your childhood, and grieving what you never were able to have as a result of the trauma. And as you grieve, you create space. So again, the emotions that we don't look at, that we don't process, that we don't grieve, don't go away. They just stay within us, and they become like heavy bags, heavy suitcases with stones in them that we carry. So when we grieve, it's like we're opening up the suitcase and we're
dumping all that shit out,
or we're letting it out, and we're creating space, right?
For some new good fun stuff, right?
Creating space for experiences that you ultimately want. So
I know that there's a huge I wouldn't say battle, but there's a controversy, and I wanted to know what your take on this is, because I definitely value your opinion. Chemicals versus talk therapy. There's a lot of, hey, it's a chemical imbalance, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then there's a lot of, no, it's not, you know. And I know that there's a big, big, big pharma industry that's making a lot of money off of psychological drugs. And what's your take?
Right. Yes, controversial issue for sure. I don't think it has to be an either or. It doesn't have to be like, okay, I'm just gonna, you know, deal with whatever I'm feeling by, you know, antidepressants or whatever the medication is, or go to therapy. And if I really need medication, I'm not gonna take it. I think in certain situations, a person can really benefit from medication to actually, you know, to stabilize them for the time being. Certain psychological disorders may necessitate more medication, but I usually fare on the more conservative side around medication. I think, you know, really trying to understand why the person is reacting the way they are? Is it a product of their environment, their upbringing? Is it a biological thing? Trying to decipher what's going on and then respond accordingly. But I would never rule out the necessity for medication.
I think that's a fear too of a lot of people, is that they're afraid, hey, I'm going to go in, they're going to tell me I'm crazy and put me on medication, you know?
Right. Sure. No one could force you. You know,
this isn't 1950.
Exactly. I mean, therapy has such a, I guess, therapy has become civilized as of late, right?
Okay.
But when we're looking like 80 years ago, 50, 60, 70 years ago.
No one is going to lock you up and do electric shock therapy.
Yeah, therapy wasn't as civilized back then. No, so you're in a collaborative relationship with someone you trust, your therapist. And just like everything else that's talked about, medication and the possibility of introducing psychotropic meds is also something that's brought up, processed. It's not something that like a therapist could. I've never been able to force a patient to go on medication. That's not even how I conceptualize.
Even though there's maybe one or two you wanted to. Just kidding. Okay, we need to wrap up, but what's your website? How can people find out more about you and what you're talking about and blogging about and preaching?
Yeah, so I do blogs. You can look at my blogs and find me on my website, www.drpartiali.com, drpartiali.com. And you could also like my professional Facebook page, Rachel Nagar Partiali, PhD.
Awesome. And if you guys missed that because you're listening to this podcast in the car or while you're running errands, we will have links on the website outoftheboxpodcast.com. So you will be able to find Rachel and all of the fun stuff that she's talking about. Guys, get healthy. This sounds like such an amazing thing and gift that you're bringing to the world, Rachel. That's amazing.
Thank you. And thank you for giving me this opportunity, this platform to talk about something I love. And thanks for all the listeners for tuning in.
Yes. And just so you guys know, I personally know Rachel and she's very, very passionate about helping people. So everything that she's telling you, all the information she's giving you is definitely researched and accurate and helpful. So check her out. All the links are available on outoftheboxpodcast.com. As always, I'm at Funny Rosie on Twitter. Guys, go on Out of the Box Podcast on iTunes. Give us the thumbs up. Give us the stars. Leave positive reviews. If you hate us, leave negative reviews. I don't care. As long as you leave a review, because that is the number one thing that helps us go up on the iTunes radar. Share the podcast with your friends and family. As always, we're on SoundCloud and Stitcher. This has been Out of the Box Podcast with Rosie Tran.